Yes, the news just continues to get worse and worse. It was talking about what happened in over the skies of Ukraine. And if it were me and I were to pass blame, I would say that blame falls on American air traffic controllers that set the standards as to where airplanes can and cannot fly and establishes the routes. And knowing that the United States was aiding and abetting, directing and funding the Kiev regime's use of bombers and fighters to attack and kill the civilians in Donetsk and Luhansk, and that those fighting them off in Donetsk and Luhansk had finally come to use anti-aircraft weapons that they had knowingly and proudly stolen from a Ukrainian base outside of Donetsk, and had shot down four or five airplanes over the course of a week or so, and yet continue to fly commercial airplanes over that area. I mean, there's very little one can do to ascertain whether an airplane is a bomber or a civilian aircraft. I mean, when they're at altitude, they look the same. Now, it's true that fighters look different when they're flying at low altitude, but at high altitude, you can't tell the difference. So if I were to assess blame, that's where I would put the blame. And just fly around it. This is an area that the government is attacking its own people, using aircraft as bombers over civilian areas, and we know the civilians in those areas have confiscated anti-aircraft weapons and are successfully using them. So that's where I'd place the blame. I'd place the blame first on air traffic control and second on the United States for inspiring and funding this war, and for all of the NATO countries for contributing to this war that killed thousands in the Ukraine. Now, if I were to guess as to what happened, I'd say that that the Russian, ethnic Russians, not Russian in terms of the country of Russia, but the ethnic Russians who were, you know, Russian citizens until 20 years ago, mistook the aircraft as another Ukrainian bomber and brought it down, and then felt horribly afterwards because of the accident. And you chalk it up to an accident that is the consequence of inspiring a war, which is what the United States did when it had the thugs take over Kiev and oust the popularly elected government. So that's, and you leave it right there. There's nothing more to it. But that's not what we're finding. No, the West wants to have a scapegoat. They want to have a villain. So right now we have Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott. So if you're an Australian, I know a lot of Australians listen to this program, particularly in archives. If you're an Australian and you took part in electing Tony Abbott, shame on you. He said he has plans to confront Russian President Vladimir Putin over the shooting down of the Malaysian passenger plane in July. Now, I can assure you one thing. I mean, absolutely guarantee that Vladimir Putin had nothing to do with bringing down that airplane. There is a 0% chance that Vladimir Putin had anything to do with that airplane. Bringing down the airplane was counterproductive to everything Russia wants to achieve in that region. They most certainly didn't do it. Now, there's a whole host of alternatives I've given you, which is the most likely. But, of course, the debris itself looks very different than a missile. But, nonetheless, it is certain that Vladimir Putin had nothing to do with it. If you're trying to scapegoat Vladimir Putin to do it, then you are showboating. And here's the idiot that was elected Prime Minister of Australia, and he's standing up in the United Nations, and he says, I'm going to be saying to Mr. Putin that Australians were murdered. They were murdered by Russian-backed rebels using Russian-supplied equipment. And he says, I'm going to, as a particular term that they use. He says, because they were murdered with Russian support, I'm going to shirt front Mr. Putin. Now, shirt front is an Australian sports term. Australian football means aggressively charging and then knocking down one's opponent. Bravado. Now, is there the possibility that the airplane was brought down with a Buk missile? Yeah. Now, does the gang of thieves in Ukraine out of Kiev have Buk missiles? Absolutely. Do the Russian rebels have Buk missiles? Yes. In fact, there's pictures of them taking over a base in the Donetsk and Luhansk area and confiscating one of those missile launchers, not given to them by the Russians, taken over by an abandoned base. Both of them had them. Having nothing to do with Russia. Nothing. Zero. And one of the two fired it and likelihood brought it down, although the evidence doesn't show a missile strike. But still the most likely scenario. But there's no Russian support here. None. No incentive for Russia to provide support. No need for Russia to provide support. No evidence of any Russian support. And Russian support is counterproductive to Russia. Now, Abbott, you've got to be smarter than that. I mean, you may be a sports fan and all bravado, and you're going to go and charge Vladimir Putin and knock him down because you think you're just God's gift to humanity. But you're wrong. The only positive thing that's happened in Ukraine is the Russian peace treaty. And the Russian peace treaty would have prevailed had the United States and other NATO nations not worked against it. And they're working against it by after the peace treaty, where the gang of thieves in Kiev agreed to grant independence for 2 years to Donetsk and Luhansk and the regions surrounding them. And then built a military base at the Donetsk airport. You know, you've got your airport for your city, and it's a military base for the people that just said you have independence. Huh? And so all of the fighting and killing since then, the shelling of Luhansk, and the return fire, is all because the United States won't let this war die. The Russians are the peacemakers here. It's NATO and the Americans and the Australians that are the provocateurs. You want to shirt front somebody? Grab your own shirt. Pretty pathetic, Mr. Abbott. Maybe you will win the Imbecile of the Week award. Islamic State Mujahideen are continuing to battle those who embrace death, the Kurdish fighters, in an essentially abandoned town called Kobane. And one way or another, I don't know if Kobane's going to fall to the Islamic State, whether it's going to be confiscated by Turkey, whether it's going to be bombed into oblivion, whether the Kurds are going to say, yay, you know, we prevailed, or the Islamic State runs through the street. There's nobody left there. You know, there's nobody left there. It's just, and everybody that's a civilian that could leave has already left. You know, this notion of this great massacre. Yeah, some old people that weren't very mobile might still be there, but nothing really left of the place. We ought not care. But we're bombing and fighting, and now the Pentagon is saying that airstrikes alone won't save the Syrian town from being overrun by the Islamic jihadists. What's interesting, of course, is that the news is, and it's consistent, the Islamic State has made consistent gains ever since America began its airstrikes. They came within one maneuver of taking over Baghdad's airport over the weekend. They had a clear path. They chose not to do it. Could have easily have done it. Would have killed a lot of Americans in the process. But they have become vastly more popular and vastly more successful as a direct result of the United States declaring war on them, claiming that they're not Islamic. And it was exactly as I told you it would be. Islam is the most deadly pathogen on the planet today, but it's not the only deadly disease. And Tanzania, a beautiful country, one of my, if not my single favorite place to go because of the wonderful game reserves. I just love the Ngorongoro and the Serengeti that lay out in front of one in, as you move through Tanzania. Marvelous place to see nature at its very best. Well, Tanzanian police have charged 23 people with murder after seven villagers were burned alive on suspicion of witchcraft. Though the attacks and this particular village in the western Kigoma region happened on a week ago Monday, the reports are just beginning to surface. Five of those killed, the witch doctors, were over the age of 60. Two others were over 40. A Tanzanian human rights group estimates that 500 suspected witches are killed each year in Tanzania. 500 are killed a year. What are they afraid of? You know, being a witch doctor in Africa is something that has gone on for a very long time. Native peoples employed witch doctors. You can call them whatever you want to call them, and there's a whole lot of names that are used for them. But those animists, the religions of the natural world, have witch doctors. And, you know, if somebody doesn't want to play along with the religion, fine. But if somebody wants to play that religion, bad idea, waste of time, counterproductive, stupid, don't go kill them. You know, witch doctors are not like Islamic jihadists. Islamic jihadists are kidnappers, slave traders, mass murderers. They're extraordinarily lethal. Witch doctors probably have never saved anybody. But they don't go around hunting people down to kill them either. Witnesses, speaking of the witch doctors that were killed, said that the victims were attacked with machetes and their homes were burned. The son of one of the victims told Tanzania's newspaper, "When I returned home in the evening, I found the body of my mother lying 30 feet from our house while the body of my father was burnt inside." I mean, come on, folks. You're going to be a ruthless savage? Why? On religious grounds? You think your God is going to stand up and go whoop whoop because you took a machete and hacked a old woman to death and then you burnt an old fellow alive in his house? Between 2005 and 2011, reports say that 3,000 people were killed after being accused of being witches. I don't know what goes through people's minds. There's a lot of confusion over what happened in Kiev. This Reuters story is interesting. For some Ukrainians, it was a crime against humanity. This was back in February when more than 100 protesters were allegedly gunned down in an uprising that led to the toppling of Yanukovych, the popularly elected leader of Ukraine. The victims were known as the Heavenly 100. I'll guarantee you there's not a single one of those victims in heaven. Not one. In April, prosecutors arrested three suspects, members of an elite unit within the riot police. A senior among them was Sedonvik, 38, a decorated commander who was accused of ordering his men to fire on the crowds that morning. Now, by the way, the crowds that day provoked the response. They were armed. And they began to shoot at the police. They began to go into public buildings. They moved out of the square, went into public buildings, set them on fire. They were throwing Molotov cocktails at the police. At the encouragement of the United States, they took it up a notch. They brought it on themselves. In April, prosecutors arrested three suspects. The three stand accused of massacring 39 unarmed protesters. No, that's just not true. The protesters were armed. And even those without guns were throwing Molotov cocktails. On September 19th, the case took a turn when a judge released the lead suspect, Senovic, put him under house arrest. The activists, of course, were enraged. That's what they do best. Convinced that a corrupt system had let a killer escape, the judge was placed under investigation. The prosecutor said in a statement that Sedlbeck was suspected of an extremely grievous crime, aiming to avoid punishment, disappeared from his place of permanent residence. But in a country where justice is very seldom found, I mean, Ukraine is a group of people, they're thugs. I mean, you do not want Ukrainians as your dependents, which is what happened to American taxpayers when your government decided to provide $25 billion to them. And there is no justice there. Sedlbeck was being framed. He sought flight as his best option. In court last month, he called the case against him a political lynching. In the days before he banished, his wife and his lawyers say that he and his family received multiple death threats. That's what the Ukrainians are like, after all. It was the mobsters of Kiev. Reuters examinations of Ukraine's probes into the shootings that day are based on interviews with prosecutors, defense attorneys, protesters, police officers, and legal experts. And it has uncovered serious flaws in the case against Senovic, as well as the other two officers that were arrested. Among the evidence presented against Senovic is a photograph. Prosecutors say it shows him near the Kiev Independence Square wearing a mask and holding a rifle with both of his hands, his fingers clearly visible around the rifle as he takes aim at the unarmed protesters. Only one problem. Senovic doesn't have two hands. His right hand was blown off in a grenade training accident 6 years ago. The picture that they've used to identify him being there, saying that he participated. Yeah, not him. Oops, he can't shoot. Photograph isn't the only problem. The probes have been hindered by missing evidence. The guns that were allegedly used to shoot the protesters have all vanished. The bullets that were fired at the protesters that hit barricades and the like, they've been taken home as souvenirs. The barricades that were allegedly hit by these bullets, they've all been confiscated. And by the protesters themselves, not by the forensic individuals in Kiev. A former Berkat commander told Reuters that Berkat officers have been wrongly convicted and that there is no evidence. So we'll have to wait to see how that all plays out, but it is beginning to look like it originally looked, like Putin described it, as a pogrom, as Kiev Ukrainians displaying the kind of violence and depravity that caused Ukraine to be the site of the two most egregious anti-Semitic attacks of the Holocaust. Dateline Baghdad. I hinted at this, but the jihadists of the Islamic State have infiltrated one of Baghdad's outer suburbs, Abu Ghraib. And remember, Abu Ghraib was the site of the prison that the Attorney General under George W. Bush ordered the CIA to order the military to torture the Muslims that had been incarcerated there. And then when they did as they were told to do, the low-ranking army specialists that conducted the torture were thrown into prison, while the attorney general who justified it was never even criticized publicly. Well, they're in Abu Ghraib now, the Islamic State. And it's a cause of concern now that the Iraq Defense Ministry, which is an American army given to the Shia Muslims loyal to Iran, has confirmed that the Islamic State has manpads, has shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles. Oops. The Iraqi army is still patrolling Abu Ghraib, but they play cat and mouse with the Islamic State, who stage hit-and-run attacks on the security forces. It's a mixed picture around the city. The Islamic State took over the city of Fallujah quite some time ago. It was one of the first cities they took over. In fact, they took over Fallujah because the Awakening Program Sunnis were disgusted by the Iranian-backed Shia military that America had provided that was bombarding Fallujah with attack helicopters, with tanks, and with artillery. And they said, to hell with you. And that's when the Islamic State formed as a merger of the Awakening Program and the Mujahideen fighting in Syria. So in Fallujah, they control it. The security forces have fought for a year to oust them from Fallujah, but to no avail. Instead, and in spite of weeks of U.S.-led airstrikes, instead of spite of, actually benefited by U.S.-led airstrikes, the Islamic State continues to extend its reach. This is exactly what I told you was going to happen. That when the United States declared war on the Islamic State, when they started bombing them, it would serve the interests of the Islamic State. If you're going to fight a religious foe, you are never going to prevail with bullets and bombs. You prevail against a religious foe with words wielded wisely. Tell the truth. Instead, America, from the Obamanator on down, but on both sides of the aisle, have lied on behalf of the Islamic State. And so, we continue to enrich our opponent. The fundamentalist group is now present and in control of a huge swath of countryside, forming a 180-degree arc around the Iraqi capital. From due north, around to the west, and all the way to the south. Around this zone, there have been skirmishes, occasionally heavily fighting with Iraqi security forces and Shiite militias, but the fundamentalist Muslims prevail. American jets have carried out more than 24 airstrikes just in that area, mainly near Fallujah and the city of Ramadi, further to the west. And when we do, we kill civilians. But Iraq is extraordinarily vulnerable at the moment. The related article says that despite the U.S. airstrikes, the Islamic State is in a position to control Baghdad, particularly its airport. Yet some military experts believe that the terror group, who now control most of Iraq and Syria, won't be able to take down the airport. And so the cat-and-mouse game continues. However, their new position inside of Baghdad does give them the ability to wreak terror in Iraq's largest city, with its suicide attacks and assaults further eroding confidence in Iraq's Shiite government. quote, it's not plausible at this point to envision the Islamic State taking control of Baghdad. But they can make Baghdad so miserable that it would threaten the legitimacy of the central government, said Richard Brennan, an Iraq expert with the RAND Corporation. Wow. I don't think the Islamic State has any interest in taking down Baghdad. I think they have an interest in inflicting great pain on Baghdad. But it's not that they couldn't take it down. Where they've engaged the Shiite army that the United States gave to the Iranian coalition there, they have prevailed. But there's too much of Baghdad that is Shia. I think what the Islamic State has realized is that they're happy for the most part, so long as the Kurds are in their own little enclave in northern Iraq, to leave the Kurds alone. Now, if the Kurds become menacing in any way, they'll go right after them. But if the Kurds stand back and stop crying for more weapons, crying for aerial bombardments, if the Kurds stand back, the Islamic State is fine to give the Kurds a little strip of territory. And I don't think the Islamic State has any interest in taking on Iran, which means Baghdad. Baghdad is in control, and Iran controls Baghdad. I don't think they want any part of eastern Iraq, which is almost exclusively Shia. Now, I do think they wish to push forward, that there is every reason that they will entrench and that they might someday invade Jordan. But I think their real interest is in taking over majority Sunni communities where they're welcome. And that's the only reason they haven't taken over Baghdad. A related article on the Islamic State is published by a series of small newspapers in America. And it was not spectacular, but it was more honest than most presentations in the media. It's not something you would find in the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Boston Globe or the Los Angeles Times or the Chicago Tribune. No, the big liberal newspapers are never going to say this, nor is any of the larger media outlets in the United States, but smaller newspapers still printed this article. Let me share it with you. The Islamic State of Iraq, sometimes called ISIS, is a Sunni extremist group. It's not a Sunni extremist group. It's a Sunni fundamentalist group that follows Al-Qaeda's anti-Western ideology. That's not true either. They don't follow Al-Qaeda. They're opposed to Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda doesn't have a Western anti-West ideology. It's just Islam is anti-everything but Islam. And sees a holy war against the West as a religious duty. That's only remotely true. It's not even significantly true. The Islamic State is focused on Syria and Iraq. Not focused on America. America has deliberately misstated their intentions so that it has a justification for another war, so that it can go and use its military, so that Americans, you know, go along blindly like lemons and wave the flag and pretend like their government is protecting them. With regard to non-believers, the Quran commands, and kill them wherever you find them and turn them out from where they have turned you out. The Quran contains many other verses that call for Muslims' violence against non-believers for the sake of Islamic rule. Contrast the words of the Quran with statements of the limp-wristed Western leaders such as President Barack Obama. We have affirmed that the United States is not and never will be at war with Islam. Islam teaches peace. While reacting to the Islamic State slaughter of British civilian David Hines, Prime Minister David Cameron said Islam is a religion of peace. Then there was the U.S. Secretary of State's explanation, the real face of Islam is a peaceful religion based upon the dignity of all human beings. But John Kerry and other Western politicians calling Islam a religion of peace doesn't make it so. Yeah, they're a newspaper that actually got that part right. They didn't go so far as to say that the President of the United States, the Prime Minister of the UK, and the Secretary of State for the United States are lying, deliberately, knowingly, purposefully lying on behalf of Islam. But you can read through the lines of this text and come to that conclusion. A debate about whether Islam is a religion of peace is not entirely irrelevant to the threat of the West posed by the Islamic State. I would like to gather a news conference and our Army Chief of Staff, the Marines commanders, and the Chief of Naval Operations, the U.S. Air Force's Chief of Staff, and to conduct such debate. This would be my question to them. And I will share that question when Shattering Myth returns after the commercial break. This is his question, this person who was writing this editorial. It was published in some smaller newspapers, and not the world's best question. But here it is nonetheless. The best intelligence puts the Islamic State at 35,000 to 40,000 people, actually. If that's true, then they're continuing to grow at a very rapid rate, because 3 months ago, the United States intelligence put the Islamic State at 20,000, and then 30,000. This is beyond that. Do you officers think that the combined efforts of our military forces could defeat and lay waste to the Islamic State at 35,000 to 40,000 people? And before they had a chance to answer, I'd say, do you think that the combined military forces of NATO and the United States could defeat and eliminate such a small group? Depending on the answers given, I'd ask them whether or not these forces could also eliminate Iran's capability of making nuclear weapons. I don't know why you'd combine those two. They're on the opposite spectrum. And Iran is anti-Islamic State. The Islamic State is anti-Iran. If you want to throttle Iran, the best way to throttle Iran is to allow the Islamic State to continue to grow in popularity and weaponry. Now, the Islamic State is not only a threat to Assad, but it is the most serious threat to Iran. And so if you're going to want to wipe out the Islamic State, then you're actually aiding and abetting Iran and its development of nuclear weapons. Once again, a guy recognizes that the Quran is a declaration of war, and yet he can't put the pieces together. He doesn't understand the difference between Sunni and Shia Islam. The Iraq that is now Iran West and its only foe. My question to my fellow Americans is, what do you think their answers would be? No beating around the bush. Does the U.S. have the power to defeat the Islamic State and their threat and stop a nuclear ambition in Iran? Yes or no? No and no is the answer. Here, the United States, between its intelligence finding, I hate to use the term intelligence because we don't display much of it, spying. Between the United States' spying, its military, and its military hospitals, we spend $1 trillion a year. And that $1 trillion is not capable of defeating the Islamic State. That's reality. The Islamic State, according to the United States, may be 30,000 strong. And our $1 trillion a year isn't capable of stopping them. And rather than stopping the nuclear ambitions of Iran, we are aiding and abetting them. Our invasion of Iraq removed Iran's only enemy. And now we're attacking the Islamic State that has taken over as the world's only legitimate foe of Iran. And we have provided Iran with a mighty military. via the Shiite government in Iraq. So rather than precluding Iran from developing its nuclear weapons, the United States has aided and abetted the process. And the Obamas' negotiations with Iran, which we detailed in this program 9 months ago, was laughable. We got absolutely nothing and gave them everything. And we continue to play around with an agreement that will go nowhere. I mean, it's over, folks. The Islamic State will not be defeated by the United States or its coalition of NATO. The $1 trillion is insufficient because it's a war machine for a war that will never be fought. And it is incapable of dealing with a religious enemy, particularly when we lie on behalf of that enemy. And the Iranians will complete their nuclear bomb. There is no nation on earth that will stop them. That's the reality. People in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, even the Middle East now, are more optimistic about their children's future than are Americans or Europeans. The very thing I've been saying on this program is true. The whole world knows that the future is bleak, that politicians, religious institutions, the institutions of man are leading us astray. And this is a story we'll cover on this program tomorrow.